For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Yeah, so today we're going to be talking about wise wives from the Proverbs, God's wisdom about being a wife from the Proverbs. Actually, last CT, me and Ryan weren't here, and it's because we were just celebrating our 13th wedding anniversary last week. Yeah, I would say that we have a really good marriage, but it wasn't always that way. I think when it started out, I was so selfish and so bratty and just unreal that if I told you stories from those days, you guys probably wouldn't even be able to relate with me now. But yeah, I was 20 years old when I got married, and one of the many things that I was into doing that was uncool was that Ryan really liked to be a homebody and sort of hang out and watch TV at night, and you know, really loved it when I was there and would do that with him. And I just felt super rebellious against that. I would always find something to do in the evenings and be out late, be out till 2 in the morning, things like that. I don't even know why. I don't even know what was compelling me to be that way. Just some sort of rebellious declaration of freedom or something like that. But yeah, there are things like that in our lives that we do by instinct that, you know, are just so weird and selfish. And so we're going to be learning some about that. But one good thing that I can say, one good lesson from early in marriage that I can give is who I chose to marry and why I chose to marry them. And I think, you know, I did that right, because as we're going to see today, what the excellent wife or the virtuous wife, the main thing about her is that she has the fear of the Lord. And I was looking for somebody with the fear of the Lord when I was looking for a spouse. I was looking for somebody who loved God, who I could tell loved God, who, when I talked to him, he made me want to love God more. And I would just recommend that to anyone who's single here today, that that's what you want to hold out for, according to the Proverbs. So let's go ahead and get into it. So far in Proverbs, we've been talking about wisdom, and one of the main teaching tools that Proverbs uses is this really black and white, here's what's good, here's what's bad. Here's the fool, as we learned a couple weeks ago, versus the wise. Or the lazy, you know, the sluggard. We had a lesson on that, versus the hardworking. There's the angry versus the patient. And there's a whole bunch more. We're only talking about some of the biggest ones that are repeated the most often. And as we'll see today, the mean wife versus the virtuous wife. And as I say that, you probably have two things that pop into your head right away. And the first one is, why is he singling out the wife? You know, why isn't he talking about the nice husband versus the mean husband? Well, we have to remember that this was written in the form of wisdom passed down from fathers to sons. And so in the Proverbs, he's recommending to his son, marry a woman like this, not a woman like this. So that's why there are so many verses on wives. And there's other places in the Bible where it talks about being a nice husband, but in the Proverbs, there's multiple verses about being a nice wife. So that's going to be what we talk about today. Now, here's the other thing that may have come into your head is a picture like this. And you might be, if you're an opinionated, out there, people know what your problems are type person, you might be thinking, well, that's me over there on the left, and I'm never going to be like that person over there on the right. Or if you tend to be a more together person whose sins are more suppressed and secret, you might think, well, I guess I'm probably the person on the right, because I definitely am not as bad as that person on the left. Either way, to put yourself into one of these pictures is going to be to completely take away any opportunity for the Proverbs to teach you anything, because that is not how learning from this style of black and white wisdom works. What works is that we have to realize that each and every one of us as wives really look like this. That's us. And wisdom is seeing that mixed up monster and being able to let God transform the darker parts and develop and empower the brighter parts. So yeah, that's us. And this is going to be kind of the thesis verse for our talk today, Proverbs 14, verse 1, which says, "A wise woman builds her house, but a foolish one tears it down with her own hands." So, yeah, the wise woman builds her house. She builds up members of her household. She is helpful to them. She wants to encourage them and make them better. The foolish one, though, is just breaking apart her house with her own hands. And I'm only 33 years old, but I even in so far in my life have already seen multiple friends of mine do this with their marriages and with their families, and they feel like, what did I do? I just broke it down with my own hands. So there's something really somber and serious here too in this verse. It's not just, oh shucks, I destroy my house with my own hands. It's something deep and serious that can happen here. And it's a serious, somber warning. Wisdom means that we will strive to build up our households and not destroy them. So our main passage today is going to be in Proverbs 31, that famous ending Proverbs about the good wife. But first, I just wanted to share a couple of the earlier Proverbs about our dark side, about the wicked witch of the West. Here's one: a wife's quarreling is a continual dripping of rain. Here's another one like it: it is better to live on the corner of a housetop than in a house shared with a quarrelsome wife. So here he's discussing that living with a wife like this, who is mean, who wants to fight, and who's brawling — the word quarrelsome means brawling, like let's brawl. And he says it's annoying, it's hard to live with. He likens it to a drip of rain. I sort of tend to think of the adults in the Charlie Brown who are like, wah, 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 you know what I mean? And that a wife who's always coming up with problems starts to sound like that. But, and that's sort of the idea that he's giving here, that a wife will start to sound like drip, 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 and you can't even hear what it is that she's trying to say anymore. Quarrelsome. I think that we have to think through, what is it that we want as wives? Do we want a really strong, respectable, built-up man as a husband, or do we want something else? And Ryan always brings up the movie Little Mermaid, because Ursula, the sea witch, has this little garden of shriveled up people that look like plants, and they're stuck and they're, you know, helpless. And he's like, some wives, you know, want to be like Ursula. They want to be like a sea witch and, you know, shrink their husband down like that. No, that's not what we really want, I hope. But I was talking to my brother Brett, and he said that he was just speaking to someone who was engaged, a girl who was about to get married. And she was like, what I really want is a strong husband. I don't want to be able to just control him and have him be like a puppy dog that does everything I say, but I'm still going to try. I'm going to try to control him. I just hope that I don't always win and succeed. And I just thought that's so funny and so honest, but what a mixed up, funny creature a woman is, and so hard for a man to try to distinguish what it is. I think when it comes to what is it that we want, for me, a movie that's always sort of gotten to me in this way is Gone with the Wind, because in that movie, even though Scarlett O'Hara is this over-the-top character that no one could totally relate to because she's just over the top, still, the point that's made there is that she treats her husband bad, she doesn't have any sort of appreciation for him, takes him for granted, won't listen to him, is impossible to work with. And eventually, when it clicks and she realizes, no, I do love this person and I do want a good relationship with him, it's too late. That's when he's like, frankly, my dear, I don't give a blank, or whatever. And he, you know, he's been beat down too much, and he's done. Over, it's too late. And so I think that's a warning to me that something that I may want in the future, I could be destroying right now. goals versus desires, I think this helps us sort of get underneath and beneath the behavior of being quarrelsome to what it is that's really going on deep inside, not just trying to manage the behavior, but to try to manage what it is that's in our thoughts and in our hearts. And this is a quote from Larry Crabb, The Marriage Builder, one of my favorite chapters in any book about marriage. I think it's just excellent, this chapter about desires and goals. He gives this example. My objective may be that it rain this afternoon. If I perceive my objective of rain as a goal, I'll set about to find some way to make that happen. But because I do not have the ability to control whether or not it rains, I will only experience frustration and anger. And he goes on to describe and differentiate the difference between a desire and a goal. A desire is something that we have when we want something, but it is outside of our control, just like raining. If it has to do with another person's free will, then that counts as a desire because we can't control their free will, for example. Or if it has to do with some natural law like rain. Then he talks about goals, which are within our control. And he says the appropriate response to a desire is prayer, but the appropriate response to a goal is a set of responsible actions. So if I were to change my mindset in this example here and say to myself, I'm not going to say rain is my goal because that's outside of my control, but I will say getting my lawn wet is my goal. That is something I can do something about. Then I can go out to the store, buy a sprinkler, sprinkle my lawn. I can have a set of responsible actions because I've made an appropriate goal. And we, unfortunately, as spouses, often have this completely wrong. And we will be making it our goal, something with our spouse that involves their free will, and we only experience that frustration and anger and quarrelsomeness, like it says here, rather than understanding the distinction. So let's go ahead and get into our main passage here. Proverbs 31, the second half, starting in verse 10. This is a poem. It's actually also an acrostic, meaning that each beginning letter of each statement is a successive letter in the Hebrew alphabet. So it's just poetic arrangement like that. It's the conclusion to the book of Proverbs. This is the last thing there. But interestingly also, this is written by Lemuel, so it's not one of Solomon's Proverbs, but it also specifically says that he relates it as it was related to him as an oracle from his mother. So this isn't just a father giving his son advice, it's also a mother giving son's advice about how to find a good wife. Starts out, an excellent wife who can find, she is far more precious than jewels. So it starts out talking about how a great wife is really valuable. And I think that's an important point to make. Finding a wife is finding a good thing. I think when you read all those proverbs about how it's better to live on the corner of a roof than with this wife, it might seem like the proverbs is saying a wife is a drag. But no, in many places in the Proverbs, it does talk about how finding a wife is finding a good thing. Here's one that we already read back when we studied Proverbs 5. Rejoice in the wife of your youth. Also, it says an excellent wife is the crown of her husband, that she is something, you know, that makes him feel awesome, like a king. House and wealth are inherited from fathers, but a prudent wife is from the Lord, that she's a gift from God, a wife. And here, which is really stating it simply, he who finds a wife finds a good thing and obtains favor from the Lord. So the Lord is favorable toward marriage and towards husbands and wives. And when I was reading commentaries about this verse, it made it really clear that it wasn't qualifying this word wife at all. Like, it wasn't saying he who finds an excellent wife finds a good thing, or he who finds a righteous wife finds a good thing, but he was saying finding a wife is a good thing in a general sense. So this is just an institution that is generally favored by God. Why? I think because investing deeply at this level is so good for us. Giving deep love just brings a character change in us that really can't be brought any other way, and also brings a spiritual joy in us to be that giving at that level. And also, I think God is able to use this relationship, the husband-wife relationship, to really enrich us and meet some of our deepest emotional needs. God will meet through our spouse, and God will speak to us through our spouse. The next verse says, "The heart of her husband trusts in her, and he will have no lack of gain." So this character quality that's being talked about here is trustworthy. Versus a verse like this, which says, "A continual dripping on a rainy day," there's that theme again, "and a quarrelsome wife are alike. To restrain her is to restrain the wind or to grasp oil in one's hand." And so what he's sort of discussing and describing here is that this is a wife who is totally unrestrained. You can't work with her. It's like trying to hold on to wind or oil. It just drips out. I think this is describing someone who won't listen. You know what I mean? Who will never listen, who you can't work with, who's sort of wife gone wild or something like that, out of control. It does not have to be out of control like a surly, mean, lazy wife like Roseanne or something who you can't work with and you can't reason with. It could also mean someone who just spends money like crazy and can't be trusted in that sense, or really is flirtatious with people, or who is self-destructive in some way and who really is unrestrained and won't listen, won't be teachable, or has no respect for what it is that her spouse might try to say to her about it. Next, "She does him good and not harm all the days of her life." So this is just like the main thesis verse that we read in the beginning, where she builds up her house and doesn't tear it down. I put helpful there, but I could also put not destructive. She's not destructive. Here's a verse that's in the same passage. It's Proverbs 31, verse 3, or a little bit earlier on. He says, "Don't give your strength to women, your ways to those who destroy kings." And here he's talking about the fact that wives can have a real destructive power. And we definitely see this in examples in the Bible. In fact, the main author of Proverbs, Solomon, it said, was destroyed by his wives. And it just spells it out. His wives turned his heart away from God. And, you know, he went against God's advice in marrying them, but then he sort of reap destruction from that, and the kingdom crumbled after him because of that. I also, when I think about this, tend to think about not just the overt destruction that wives can cause, but also the much more subtle. And I thought of actually the example of Rebecca, who is Isaac's wife in the Old Testament, and she has twins. And the older twin gets tricked out of his birthright by the younger. And, you know, the younger is called the schemer. And, you know, it seems like he just tricked his older brother and got this thing. But actually, if you read that story carefully, you'll see that Rebecca was very much involved at every level here. She's the one cooking the meal. She's the one like, "I'll wrap this hair around your arms and you go in there and you say this," and you know what I mean? She's pulling the strings there. And the result of it, if you're thinking of and empathizing with her, is that she never got to see her son again the rest of her life, because he ended up living somewhere else and needing to run away. That's another more subtle way that we can really destroy our households too. I think, you know, we tend to think about our destructive power as individuals more in terms of our role as parenting, and we're worried and we don't want to mess up our kids, but we think of it more in terms of parenting than we do as our role as a spouse. I don't really think about the fact that the things I do could be really destructive to my spouse, but that's what the Bible teaches can happen. Here's the next set of verses. "She seeks wool and flax and works with willing hands. She is like the ships of the merchants. She brings food from afar. She rises while it is still night and provides food for her household and portions for her maidens. She considers a field and buys it, and with the fruit of her hands plants a vineyard. She dresses herself with strength. She makes her arms strong. She perceives that her merchandise is profitable. Her lamp does not go out at night. She puts her hand to the distaff and her hand holds the spindle. So a few qualities here that we see in this section. The first one is that she's hardworking, and it says right away in the very beginning that she works with willing hands, or in some other versions it says with delight. So I think that's important because she's doing hard work, but it's not doing hard work scrubbing the floors and then like getting super bitter and angry and grudging inside. She wants to do it. She wants to work hard and she's willing. Also, it says that she's strong. She dresses herself with strength as we go back here and makes her arms strong. And in the verse before, it says she considers a field and buys it. And later, she perceives her merchandise as profitable. So we see that she actually has a lot more involvement in her community than most women at this time would. And in fact, it's been something of a controversy among traditional Christians, this passage, because it's like, oh my gosh, is this saying that she shouldn't be a stay-at-home mom because she went out and bought this field and planted and whatever? Is this like saying that the excellent wife would be a working mom and they're worried about that? I would just say that this passage is about virtues and about character qualities. And those things can be true of you, whatever station of life you're in. That if you're a stay-at-home mom, you can be hardworking, enterprising, creative, all the things that are being described here. If you're a working mom, you can be those things too. This is a universal virtue principle that's true and relatable to all of us. Also perceptive, you know, it talks about her perceiving that something is good and, you know, considering and so on. The next verse says she opens her hands to the poor and reaches out her hand to the needy. Something we talked about here in Proverbs a few weeks ago, being generous and giving. And if you read through, we're sort of going through this chunk by chunk, but if you read straight through this passage, it really stands out to you that what she's doing is not just to make herself great and, you know, for herself, but is for others. And I just put a few of the phrases there that is, you know, repeated throughout this passage. Does him good, gives to her household, to her maidens, to the poor, to the needy. All her household is clothed, makes coverings for herself also, delivers sashes to the merchants, teaches, opens her mouth in wisdom, shepherds her household. So you see here that she's others focused, that's the virtue talked about here. The next section of verses goes through and says, she's not afraid of snow for her household, for all her household is clothed in scarlet. She makes bed coverings for herself. Her clothing is fine linen and purple. She makes linen garments and sells them and delivers sashes to the merchants. Strength and dignity are her clothing, and she laughs at the time to come. And I loved finding this verse because when I was studying this, I actually studied this passage last. I went in order, so I was studying the earlier sort of negative passages first, and then reading about the virtuous wife at the end of Proverbs, and I had run across this verse. It is better to live in a desert land than with a quarrelsome and fretful woman. So here again we see the same sort of, it's better to live somewhere than with a quarrelsome woman, but this one also adds the dimension of being fretful or complaining. Some versions say complaining. When I was thinking about this, I wrote down some examples of being fretful. And then I also was trying to think, what is the opposite of this? What's the opposite of being fretful? And I had written down on my card, being hopeful, because someone who's fretting is worried about the future, whereas someone who is hopeful is strong and confident about the future, and also proactive, and I even wrote brave, because this is someone who, instead of being worried and fretting, is able to say, well, I'm going to go ahead and make this plan, and I'm not worried about it. And as we go back and read these verses, we see it's exactly what it was, the exact opposite of being fretful, laughing at the time to come and Early are not afraid of snow because she's clothed them in scarlet. So that was a real interesting revelation to me, because in 1 Peter, when it talks about husbands and wives, it says, make yourself beautiful like the women of old used to make themselves beautiful. And then it says, and don't be frightened by any fear. And I always wondered to myself, why did they include that as the conclusion statement for don't be frightened by any fear? But I think that it's talking about having this like hopeful and proactive attitude. Here's a few examples that I wrote down of being fretful. If you don't take the trash out now, you might forget it in the morning. If we don't get new clothes for the kids, they might get teased at school. And I'm worried a friend might be insulted by what you said last night, and I think you should call them and apologize to them, otherwise they're not going to want to hang out with us. And actually, all of those statements are like word-for-word statements that I have said to Ryan recently. So, yeah. So, not being fretful, not being so wrapped up and so worried about those types of little things. The next one says, her husband is known in the gates when he sits among the elders of the land. So here we see that the husband is social and also respected, that he's sitting among the wise people and being able to engage in wise conversation here. And I think here it's important to remember the difference between desires and goals, because even if we're the perfect wife, even if we put this wife to shame, it doesn't mean that we'll have a perfect husband, right? That's a desire, not a goal that we can make. However, there are things we can do to limit our husband's ability to be social and to be respected, such as hoarding our husbands, not letting them leave the house, making them feel guilty if they want to go be social, or belittling them to others. I brought up this verse too. An excellent wife is the crown of her husband. We read that earlier. Here's the rest of it. She who shames him is like rottenness in his bones. And, you know, shaming or belittling our husband, this is something where I actually have a personal example that's pretty embarrassing to me. But when I was first married to Ryan, and I mean, I love him and I think he's the best thing ever. But a few friends of mine were together just sort of bitching about something about him. And I was frustrated with him at that time, and I sort of just went right for it too. And I was like, yeah, he is. And furthermore, this. And you know what I mean? And actually, it ended up really affecting their relationship with him. And it's something that I felt a great deal of disappointment in with myself. And it's something I really, really regretted. So it's a lesson that I learned. And I was like, it may seem fun at the time, but I am not going to be into that. Here's the next one. She opens her mouth with wisdom, and the teaching of kindness is on her tongue. So she's a learner, also a teacher, an advisor, and kind. She teaches kindness and also wisdom to people. And this is an important verse, I think, because of lessons like the lesson of Martha and Mary, where Martha's doing all the housework and Mary's out there at Jesus's feet listening to his teaching, and Martha sort of gets upset and comes out and says, what are you doing just sitting here? Come on, let's get to work. And Jesus is like, no, Mary chose the better portion. What she's doing is right on. And Ryan always uses this term because he took German of Hausfrau. And he'll always be like, I'm glad that you're not just a Hausfrau. You know what I mean? And the Bible teaches that we don't need to just be Hausfraus, but that we're able to be learners and be able to advise people with kindness and with our wisdom too. She looks well to the way of her household and does not eat the bread of idleness. And actually this word is better translated in some Bibles as shepherds. She shepherds her household and does not eat the bread of idleness. If you look at the Hebrew word, it's actually the word shepherd. And I think here we see that she's not helpless, idle, trying to be like, tell me what to do and I'll do it, but that she's taking initiative to build up her household. And the word shepherding has a taste of leadership principle in it, but it also has a taste of nurturing principle in it, that a shepherd nurtures the sheep that they take care of. And I think that's sort of what he's referring to here. And I think sometimes when I get too wrapped up in our culture and the cultural idea of what a woman is and what a modern woman should be, here I am, woman, hear me roar, and stuff like that, that I can tend to think of things like nurturing as below me or below how I should spend my time. And that's really a shame, because when I do them, when I have my neighborhood kids over and we bake chocolate chip cookies together or something like that, and I'm nurturing to them and to my own kids, it's like, this feels right. It feels good. And you know what I mean? I don't think that we need to be ashamed to be nurturing in shepherds like that. Her children rise up and call her blessed, her husband also, and he praises her. Many women have done excellently, but you surpass them all. Charm is deceitful, beauty is vain, but a woman who fears the Lord is to be praised. Give her the fruit of her hands and let her works praise her in the gates. So here it talks about a woman who is praiseworthy, and I wrote it that way on purpose, praiseworthy, because getting praise is again a desire, that even if we behave really well, it doesn't mean that we will get praise like this woman did in this proverb. Perfect example of that is Abigail, who is one of David's wives. And before she was married to David, she was married to a man whose name was Nabal, the same name that was the word for wicked fool, the meanest, worst fool that we learned about 2 weeks ago. And there's no way that he was praising her, even though she was a really praiseworthy, discerning, wise woman. It talks about how he was only cruel and evil to her. So what's being talked about here, again, is a character quality and a virtue, the virtue of being praiseworthy, which we can be whether we are praised or not. So just before we conclude, I wanted to give a quick summary, because we went through these so back and forth. What the Proverbs teaches about the mean wife and about our wicked witch side, the things that are inside of us and do come out sometimes, is that we can be quarrelsome, we can be fretful, we can be unrestrained, hard to deal with, hard to do anything with. We can shame our husbands, we can destroy them, and we can tear down our household. When it talks about being the virtuous wife, it talks about being trustworthy, hardworking, strong, wise, generous, teaching others, praiseworthy, and building up our household. But let's go back now and conclude by looking at the three things that make a woman beautiful or attractive, because this is sort of how the Proverbs end up closing up here, is in verse 30. Charm is deceitful, beauty is vain, but a woman who fears the Lord is to be praised. So there's three things here that can make a woman attractive. Charm, being able to win people over with our great relational skills or with our personality. Beauty, our physical appearance, and also the fear of the Lord. And he says here, those first two things, those are vain. They don't last. But the third thing does. And the person who has that third thing is to really be praised. If you think about charm, think about the most charming person you know. Let's say every time you hang out with them, you go away feeling awesome and like, that person is so cool and they make me feel so good. But think about, what if they lived with you every day and their annoying habits were coming out? How long would that charm last? It would wear thin. It eventually would matter how charming they were. Same with beauty. Beauty wears off, it wears thin. But the fear of the Lord here, he's saying, is a foundation that really lasts and can last through all of the storms and all of the troubles of marriage. The fear of the Lord is how Solomon began the book of Proverbs. And when he began, he talks about how the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. And when he ends the book of Proverbs, it's actually Lemuel who ends it, but he ends by saying that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of a spiritually virtuous life, and it's the ultimate thing needed to have a spiritually virtuous life. Also, it's the foundation that'll stand the test of time. So, yeah, and I just wanted to end by sharing with you guys something from a teaching that my friend Jen Ferguson did this summer, because this was really challenging to me. And she did a teaching on marriage, and it was about husbands and wives, and this statement she made, at first I was like, is that true? Can that be true? But the more I thought about it and the more I heard her explanations, it was like, that is true. She said, your spouse is the most important person in your life. And I tended to think, what about my kids? Because there I really see my role and the importance. And, you know, if I were to neglect them, I would, like, be taken to jail. You know what I mean? But I tended not to think of my spouse as the most important person in my life. And if he is or she is the most important person in my life, because God has joined us together, for example, in Malachi 2, it talks about how there's a physical bond of becoming one flesh, but it says also God puts his spirit in us in a uniting way that is different. There's some new third dimension to us coming together. Do I think of him that way? And do I treat him that way? Do I behave as though that were true? Is he the person that I pray the most about? Is he the person that I think about, how can I make him better? How can I help him? How can I encourage him when he's down? Is he the person who I spend time with, who I make sure my schedule's cleared out for you? Maybe not. Maybe I don't really think that, and I take that for granted. But when it comes to other relationships, even those of our children, they eventually are going to grow up and connect to someone else, to leave their father and mother and cleave to their spouse. And so who are we going to be with for the rest of our lives? And yes, that relationship is super, super essential and important. So that's where I wanted to conclude today.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.